This evokes the dark wraith of doubt, which in its turn calls for further and deeper investigation. But investigation soon causes pointed questions to arise. Knowledge resulting from adoption of the higher standpoint can alone proffer a satisfactory answer to these questions because it alone deals in ultimates, whereas all other standpoints offer answers which may serve for the moment, which are useful pragmatic working views for a time, but they too are bound to fail one later under the pressure of hard facts. History proves how governments, religions, theories and institutions fall down in the end, despite their one-time invincibility. For there is no permanent settlement except in ultimate truth. It is far less important to travel from Canada to Cape Town than to travel from the primitive point of view to the philosophic. Thus philosophy alone can become the sole apex at which all lines of the pyramid of knowledge and action must meet. Its deliverances are adamantine, they may be ratified by time but not rectified by it. The unique virtue and incomparable value of such an attitude displays itself in the daring claim which the hidden philosophy alone ventures to make, viz., that it arrives at completeness of results, uncontradictability of truth and the verified principle underlying all phases of experience and knowledge which, when attained, makes everything else understood. This claim must be tested, however, like all others, and the hidden philosophy will fearlessly and gladly submit to every imaginable test because having been always its own severest critic it is conscious of having reached a basis as solid as the rock of Gibraltar. If everywhere that which passes for philosophy differs with the philosophers themselves, nowhere can the genuine philosophy vary in essential principles by one iota from what it always has been and always must be. Thus in our quest we must learn to apply the proper standpoint. Do we want the last word in truth? Then we must approach the world from the philosophic position. Do we want a practical working view? Then we may take the limited and lower view. But whatever we do, we ought not to confuse our categories. For the penalty will be distortion of truth and inability to find the working rule. The philosophical viewpoint must be kept distinct and separate from the practical, otherwise we shall get a blurred and muddled outlook, says the hidden doctrine. Moreover, it must not be thought that to take this higher view is to destroy the lower one. The antithesis between them belongs to the world of elementary thought and does not dislocate the springs of everyday action. They can be coordinated according to individual circumstances. The two viewpoints can be distinguished but cannot be separated, cannot be divorced. We may study one apart from the other, but in doing so we make a mere abstraction of both, whereas the real is the whole. They are not to be taken as rigid divisions but as necessary distinctions. Nobody can be negligent of the first without ceasing to be a human being, whilst nobody can be negligent of the second without condemning himself to remain outside the realm of truth. Nobody can dispense with the more primitive outlook because practical life has to be based on belief to a larger extent than on truth. We have to take our cook on trust, for instance, for there is no time to investigate or supervise every minor detail of the cooking every day. This means that we must be content never to know the truth about it, never to prove that everything is as it the revelation of relativity purports to be. Active life would be impossible if we had to wait and collect all the facts before every single deed or movement, so we are compelled to take much or most of it on appearance value. Application of the higher standpoint to every petty concern of the day is neither desirable nor necessary. It would make every ordinary business a nuisance. It would be as foolish and as impossible as the attempt to apply the canons of common sense to the questions of pure philosophy. Thus it is enough that we keep perpetually present in knowledge the roundness of our earth and not demand that sight and touch should also tell us of it. It is enough that the philosopher remain a sensible human being, so long as he holds firmly to the principles that generalize the truth behind all the changing scenes of his daily diorama. Such a method, however, as the practical one is alone too defective for philosophy, which must thoroughly test every inch of its forward progress. When man begins to think of what life means and what the world means, he must leave the little compromises which make up popular existence and ascend to Himalayan mental altitudes. When he philosophizes, let him be done with all such compromises, all easy concessions to the infirmities of our adolescent race, and let him be loyal to his mistress. The movement of thought within both stages is inescapable. They are complementary. We have to coordinate them. But to confuse or to compromise the two standpoints is to mix up the issues of life and thought. From its unique standpoint, philosophy seeks to provide the final and consistent explanation of everything that exists, yet it does not deny the value of the work accomplished by those who are confined to the ordinary standpoint alone, nor the experience of those who can find truth only in what they see. But it shows up the purely relational character of such work, experience, judgment and knowledge as being quite inadequate to a comprehensive view of life which omits nothing from its survey. Thus we can adjust the claims of practical life with the claims of philosophical truth and harmonize all knowledge. For experience, science is the starting point of genuine philosophy. When it can summon up sufficient courage to make the leap, when the revelation of relativity forces it to confess it can never alone attain certitude, it will elevate itself to the mantle dignity of philosophy. It need not abandon the pursuit of practical achievements if it does this, for the two can and should be coordinated. And thus it must labor amid the turmoil of earthly strife while holding to the inner silence of unearthly being. It must reconcile the limitations that the revelation of relativity only because we do not follow light for a course of millions of miles and during a sufficiently long period of time. Could we but do so, we should find them curved. But such a discovery is subversive of all the axioms of Euclid, of all the geometry that had been based on those axioms, of all the old concepts of fixed material bodies arranged in space according to the old Euclidean laws. Euclid's geometry worked well provided it was applied only to limited portions of the universe. But when a vaster field was brought into consideration, it became unsatisfactory, and non-Euclidean systems such as Riemann's were found more adequate to the measurement of the world. Here again the expanding space sense has revolutionized even the character of mathematics. If it has demanded the giving up of limited notions, it has offered more comprehensive and more generalized explanations of physical phenomena in their place. The expansion of the time sense of mankind is equally important to thought and culture and has shown itself in various ways. Men do not get giddy nowadays at this striking change, as they would surely have done 500 years ago. The gramophone brings to their ears a voice which spoke a decade ago. The radio enables them to hear immediately speech or song which would formerly have required several days or some weeks of journeying to hear. The world of time has contracted, whereas the sense of time has enlarged. This widening of the space sense which brought the discoveries of Copernicus and of Einstein in science has also brought other new truth in its train. It is affecting the practical policies of statesmen and the theoretical principles of economists. It is influencing the major departments of human life and human culture. And to the extent that this alteration is bringing men to realize the unity of existence, to that extent it conforms to the practical teaching of philosophy concerning social life and ethical conduct. Both science and philosophy here tend to meet and their paths become increasingly less divergent. Moreover, all these new truths about space and time are bringing a great growth in the thoughts of men and a great growth in their conception of the world. They are thus preparing the public mind for more favorable reception of the truths of the hidden Indian philosophy, towards which they tend strikingly and inescapably to lead. As people get used to thinking in this newer way, it will be easier for them to appreciate the higher philosophic outlook. Relativity has provided a new worldview as the background for all future thought about things. A thorough grasp of the meaning of relativity cannot but bring to birth a new outlook for thoughtful men and emancipate their minds from dead ideas, for hitherto the characteristic of the external world was its inevitableness, its mechanical status. We were constrained and compelled by our feelings to accept it as it seemed to be. We instinctively felt that it was not a case of what we wished to think about it, but of what we must think about it. Hence everybody, even the scientists, had cherished the belief that whatever was seen to occupy a certain shape possessed a separate appearance and measurement which was objectively its own precisely as perceived. They had also believed that whenever an event happened, its duration was likewise precisely something that inhered within itself, as Newton had said, and all the scientists who followed after him had said, everywhere absolutely unchangeable and uniform and consequently quite independent of human experience of them. The stellar universe which we humans believed to be out there in space and enduring through time was quite unaffected by our position, presence or absence, and continued a uniform existence whose fundamental characteristics were the same for all observers in all ages. Space and time were once and for all given. With Einstein's advent, these views are shown to be fallacious, imperfect and misleading. He demonstrates that the conventional standards of measurement, as made in space and time, are not at all absolute and irrevocable. They are entirely dependent on factors, such as the position of an observer, which in themselves are variable and relative. What we really know of the world is not stereotyped for everybody and everywhere, but is entirely relative to a particular standpoint which we have taken up. By changing the standpoint, we shall visualize the same world in a different way. But, be it noted, to turn space into a variable is to deprive it of its Euclidean character and to make a mental factor enter it. Through the whole of last century, science, as if it were an observer who had scrutinized the world, did not know that the data it had thus gained was more useful for getting things done than for getting at ultimate truth. It was like a man in a closed astronomical system unable to tell that the Earth was moving because he had nothing else with which to compare it. But the mental sleep of the race was ending. History had marked the 20th century as the century of sudden awakening. Science began to scrutinize its own position, itself, and thus become conscious of a missing element in its observation of other movements, its own movement. Science had absorbed itself in the study of the external world but omitted to take into reckoning the student himself, the revelation of relative additions under which he worked and the preconceptions with which he worked. Yet all these were factors which entered into the observations themselves and consequently modified the results obtained. To think of the objects apart from the men who study them is to think of abstractions. It is like two ends of the same stick, you cannot have one without the other, do what you will. Somebody must be there to know the object. So far as human knowledge of them goes, they exist as known things. To treat them otherwise is to abstract one end of the stick and pretend that the other is not there. Relativity plainly states that the observer cannot be separated from his observations, that space is not a wide void in which objects are hanging, nor time a broad stream in which they are standing. The shapes we perceive, the measurements we make, depend on the position of the one who perceives and measures. Let him shift his position and new shapes and new measurements will present themselves to his gaze. Therefore, empirical knowledge is perpetually exposed to revision. We can never arrive without philosophy at a determination of the character of the universe which shall be and shall remain absolute. The inner meaning of relativity is that the world may be known differently in the experience of different human beings. The principle may be applied to the particular way in which an object appears to us from a particular position, or it may be applied to the fact that the object itself is known also as an idea in relation to a knowing mind. An object is never independent of the conditions affecting a particular observer. The universe has been deprived of unalterable entity. Relativity has converted it into a universe of individual or collective interpretation. Even if the observations of a million persons agree more or less with each other, they still remain interpretations. The principle of relativity does not forfeit its truth because a million people grouped together in a town find no difference in their general observation of a particular object. It still applies to them, albeit collectively, because they have used the same general position or set up the same general standard of reference. Apart from its practical value, which is not under consideration here, the worth of Einstein's work to the cultural world is that it gives a jolt to the smug scientific tradition which tried to make a fixed representation of the universe. It inaugurates a new era of comprehension for thoughtful minds. For the aspect of it that matters most proves conclusively that the observed universe, that is the known universe, as apart from the one supposed to be outside, depends partly at least for its appearance upon the observer himself. and anyone may enter into this comprehension. However, without turning mathematician and trying to master the technicalities of relativity, if only he will set out to study his own world more closely for what it is rather than what he feels it to be, he will then perforce see that the space and time sides of his human experience are not so objective as everyday thought holds them to be. If nothing exists in isolation, independently of its relation to the one who perceives it, then, without actually stepping into the shoes, the body and mind of another man, that is without becoming the other man, it is an impossible feat to observe any object precisely as he himself observes it. Thus we stubbornly carry OOF worldview with us wherever we go. The observations which we make are really made within it, are inseparable from it. Our world of observed facts is also a world of judgments. We separate out by abstraction some special aspect and call that the thing itself. We isolate special appearances of the object, we make an abstraction from all its possible appearances and then proceed to assert that we have seen the object. The logic which proves that the object known can never be separated from the knowing subject as an independent entity, that the observer is part of every observation which he makes, and that the world is describable only in terms of relations is unanswerable. When Einstein shows that there is no space and no time common to all groups of human beings, it is like showing that various spectacles are in use, each group's glasses being tinted differently and hence producing a different colored picture. Where do these changes of aspect really occur? The resultant pictures, when traced to their ultimate abode, are not out there in the object but in the observers themselves. If five men studying the same thing from five different positions find that it differs in size, mass, rate of movement and so on, who but themselves are responsible for the changes in the observed object? This is the only possible way of construing such relativity. Throw the observer out of your calculation and the whole system of relativity collapses. The observations are to a large extent at least dependent on the observer. The world of massive continents and majestic oceans appears to be set out in space, and yet when we reflect upon the mats, the space relations themselves are somehow inextricably mixed up with the observer who is looking at it. If the Earth looks flat and is actually round, seems stationary but is continually rotating, where is the error to be sought for? Obviously in the observer himself, for his senses are the revelation of relativity at work in molding and presenting the picture of the Earth to him. The plausible assumption which inheritance and habits have engraved upon our minds that we enter into direct connection with a world independent and apart from ourselves can no longer be justified. Relativity drags from us the rueful admission that there are always different ways of looking at the world, that there are no fundamental characteristics which all observers perceive, and that alteration of position or reference standard will alter the sensor picture of the world in the observers themselves. And that sensor picture is the only one which they unquestioningly invest with reality, for they know no other. We get our facts about the world ordinarily through the use of the five sense organs, those complicated structures which began in the far past as simple sensitive patches of skin. The scientist has to work on measurements which he has read off an instrument or an apparatus with his own faculty of sight. To that extent he is entirely dependent on the services rendered him by his two eyes. The chemist alters weights in the scale pan of a laboratory balance and then reads the figures indicated by a pointer which moves over a figured scale. Actually, his consciousness has noted certain visual sensations, certain experiences which have occurred to nervous mechanisms in his own body. Science is said to be based on measurement alone, but this is evidently an incomplete statement. The human observer must be reckoned as a part of the results too. Science cannot be separated from the scientists. Therefore, the pattern which science has created is also a pattern of human experience. This has been granted by Einstein, for he included a mathematical idea of an observer in his conclusions. And the observer in turn depends on his senses for information. But what has all this analysis to do with me? Some will ask. Is it not the special preserve of scientists and mathematicians? The answer is everything. For you, dear reader, are yourself an observer with the world which you see and the environment around you as your field of observation. Einstein's work is being used here only as an example, only to illustrate some most important tenets we may watch on a cinema screen: a slow-motion picture of a horse leaping over a hurdle. Its legs move so tardily that the animal takes 60 seconds for a feat which was actually done in 2. What has happened? The photographer has accelerated the turning of his camera handle so as to take hundreds of pictures per second, whereas the operator has projected thin on the screen at such a retarded rate that the movements are slowed down to diminishing point. It is not an illusion. The machine has actually expanded our measurement of time by altering the number of our sensations. It has simply and practically illustrated what the principle of relativity expresses 19 mathematical formulae. Of the hidden Indian teaching. He has shown that we know nothing definite about reality, and he has shown by implication the need of the higher philosophic standpoint. Moreover, although his discovery referred to quantitative measurements in space and time, it may be extended to many other fields of inquiry. Relativity is a principle which holds good almost everywhere, and its philosophic study is of consequence to you. It will serve as a useful stepping stone to a unique level of reference, where the true character of the world and later the true meaning of your existence can be unveiled. Relativity reigns in the mental world equally as in the physical. Belief colors or conditions perception. Predilection is selective and shuts out whole strata of facts from observation. Egoism is deceptive and often sees only what it likes to see. Assumption falsifies even that which it does see. Emotion overweights the trivial, deflects the mental and ignores the substantial. Imagination effortlessly manufactures the most improbable data. Moreover, Einstein's work not only strips both time and space of their independent reality, but leads logically to another point which should not be overlooked. When he makes it clear that a man on the moon would have a different kind of time to a man on the Earth, the time reference is shown to be somehow mixed up with the space reference. Relativity shows that you cannot separate space from the observer, that you cannot separate time from the observer, and that both time and space form part of a single thing. The space-time continuum is one thing, not two. There is no space without time as its inseparable coexistent companion. The when and where are forever in union. All perceptions of time must involve reference to the external world and hence involve perceptions of space too. They are inseparables. The time at which an object occupies its three dimensions in space must be brought in to complete its measurement. All our knowledge of nature is the knowledge of things extended in space and occurring in time. All our experience is the experience of objects occupying a particular spatial position and a particular time order. It is not only that we see the surrounding world, but we see it in a space-time relation. Time and space mutually imply each other, are dependent on each other. For we see objects in space separately and therefore successively and therefore in the total dimension of space-time. Conversely, if we could not separate the Earth from the Sun in space, we would have no means of measuring time, nor any revolutionary movement wherewith to mark it. Thus all our sensations are correlated in space-time. We spatialize by arbitrary withdrawal from the fourth dimensional continuum where both space and time lie perpetually united. The space-time continuum is the foundation which underlies all our experience of the world. We need not let ourselves be intimidated by the formidable sound of this word continuum. It becomes explicable when we know that space and time are relative to the mind of the observer and that this continuum is somehow inextricably mixed with the mind itself. Space-time is after all a mathematical idea, a conceptual picture, and hence a mental thing. How comes it that we seem to find space and time as separate realities? It is because the mind has unconsciously picked and partitioned them out to some degree from itself and then arbitrarily imposed them as objective discoveries upon itself. Thus the structure of the world depends partly on the structure of the mind. We must not overlook that the mind is constantly interpreting the world for us, constantly at work behind every measured movement in time and every measured thing in space. The farthest point to which science has gone is that space-time is the ultimate matrix which molds the objects and events that emerge into being. It is both their mysterious source and the fourth dimension of matter. When, However, we come to realize that space-time is itself inseparable from the mind. We shall see what direction science will be forced by further investigation and discovery to follow. The longer it hesitates to take this step, the larger will be the accumulation of proof that will confront it. From the moment that Einstein announced his discoveries, physical science could no longer stand aloof as it had done in the past from the problem of the relation of mind to the world. For relativity undermined the entire objective nature of such science and involuntarily introduced a subjective factor. Nothing, therefore, according to relativity, is completely self-existent. This interpreted world is partially, at least, dependent on the interpreting mind of the observer. The old notion that space and time were containers in which things were exhibited must go. The new notion that space and time are contained within the observed must come in. The corollary to be drawn from this is that mind and sensation are inescapable factors in the making, as apart from the perceiving, of the world we know, for that world is as inseparable from space as it is from time. Truth as it exists in itself, unconditioned, is in Einstein's belief unattainable. Truth as it exists in relation to the faculties of individual men is alone possible of attainment. The hidden teaching emphatically disagrees with this pessimism, pointing out that entity exempt from all relation can only be of a common mental nature and that it might be apprehended through a non-individual approach. Anyway, somehow and to some extent, the principles which determine human knowledge exist within the human senses and the human mind and not definitely beyond them in the universe. Without the aid of mind, we are unable to know anything at all. This proposition is irrefutable. Thus, in the stage to which we have traveled, the world hinges largely upon ourselves as observers of it. But what are we without our instruments of observation, without the five senses? Nothing. Everything is received through them. The earth on which we walk and the chair in which we sit enter into our awareness only because they are registered on the skin, the eyes and the ears. The world we know is a sense world, whatever else lies beyond it or outside it. It will vary as our fivefold sensations themselves vary. What they tell us constitutes our world. And they can tell different things to men who are differently placed. This is the fundamental lesson of relativity. Relativity introduces an individual or group character into all observations. Unreflective people do not understand that part at least of what they take to be outside themselves exists rather as sense impressions within themselves. What is believed to exist beyond these impressions is not definitely known. We are following a suggestive and exploratory trail which has led us back through the things of time and space to man himself, partly to his mind and particularly to the sensations which he forms of the world without. This raises the physiological and psychological question of how we get sensations and what they really are. We habitually accept the deliverances of the senses as true and therefore do not pause to consider how far they are true. It is the next task to investigate their precise nature, as well as to ascertain how much of what we see is dependent on this mental factor. Chapter 9. From Thing to Thought. We are now on the threshold of an ancient mystery. There is a stirring and stimulating aspect of the scientific discovery of relativity which has not been allotted its proper significance and its adequate value by the West, but which was known, understood and valued by the Indian thinkers of antiquity. And this mystery is the relation between the things of our experience, the senses and the mind. For we have come to see at this stage that every separate thing of which man is or can be aware of is apparently a product of two ingredients, the mental and the material, and not of the material alone. But in what proportions the two are mixed is a question which we have yet to answer. How much of a thing is supplied by the mind and how much is received from the external world is a riddle which has puzzled men from Kepler to Kant, more because its right answer is too unexpected and unsuspected to be acceptable than because its difficulty is too insuperable to be overcome. We know that there is around us a world of common objects such as brick houses and leafy trees. But what we really know of this world depends on how we come to know it. Talkative ignorance can assert that we see it, that certain corresponding images register on our eyes and are somehow grasped by the mind. Sight, however, is not such a simple matter as it seems. for it will yield surprising relations when subjected to analytic treatment. The average untutored mind with usual and unquestioned habit is satisfied that its awareness of the world, its personal experiences and environmental changes, are simple affairs, but the scientific mind knows how complex and elaborate they really are.